Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Coming up on today's program, a conversation with a best-selling author talking about her latest novel called Lies and Other Acts of Love. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll have a couple of different interviews, including one with a management professor at Oral Roberts University who's written a very, very interesting new book called Under New Management, which outlines some of the most innovative new practices in management that are seen across the country. Also an interesting look at the marijuana industry, of all things, in those states in the United States where the use of marijuana, to one extent or another, is legal. An entire industry has grown up, and it's thriving. And Friday's morning show will include a couple of different interviews, including a conversation with some of those who are involved in the current Carthage production of the musical Urinetown, which has performances coming up this weekend. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is archived at WGTD's website, WGTD.org. On today's morning show, we are reconnecting with a best-selling author by the name of Christy Woodson Harvey. I spoke with her on the morning show upon the publication of her debut novel called Dear Carolina. She scored a tremendous success with that and is back now with a second novel which is equally compelling, set in the South, a novel called Lies and Other Acts of Love. I really love this novel, and one of the things I appreciate about it, and I want to ask you about this, is that in some ways it's kind of a complicated novel in that we pivot back and forth between the perspective of one character, Lynn Lovey White, and her granddaughter, Annabelle. And so at each chapter, and I don't remember if it perfectly alternates, but for the most part at least, it alternates between one and the other. We are hearing from one or the other, and alternating between their own storylines, and to some extent also sometimes stepping back into the past to sort of sort out their own histories. You describe that, I describe that, and even as I say it out loud, it sounds really complicated, like a novel that's going to be very difficult to follow, and yet somehow it isn't. It is a novel that flows with wonderful clarity, and I, for one, as a reader, always like that. I don't like a novel that makes me work too hard. But I wonder if you could just say a word about the crafting of such a novel in that kind of a framework, and what you thought about in terms of trying to keep the events from these, in a sense, two different storylines clear to the listener.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you. I mean, that's a wonderful compliment. And I do think, you know, when you take on something that is a dual point of view and a dual time period, you do worry a little bit about making sure that your readers can follow along. So that was good. For me, it's really just how the story unfolds. And that sounds so simple, but that's really kind of all there is to it. And I normally don't write my books in chronological order. So that can get a little bit complicated, but I have a four-year-old son, and I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I usually only have a couple hours a day where I can sneak away and write, and so usually what I'm doing is I'll have a scene or a chapter or, you know, a part of the book that's kind of just been playing itself out in my mind, and that's usually what I decide to tackle for that day. And so it seems to me kind of unbelievable now that, you know, I look back and read Lies and Other Acts of Love that it was able to kind of come together in the way that it did. But I knew that these stories in the past were such a really important part, especially of Lovey and her husband D-Daddy's story. You know, I wanted the reader to be able to see these things that I had envisioned of how they met and how they fell in love. And their past, obviously, is a very important part of their life and their story. And of the secrets that they keep and their reasons for keeping them. And I think if we had missed out on that, you know, part set in the past, the reader might not have been able to relate to their decisions maybe as well. And so for me, that was really important. And then the other thing about that is I really wanted the reader to see Lovey and Annabelle when they were kind of at the same age. You know, I wanted them to see that these two women when they were at the same place at the same time and the different choices that they made in similar situations and how it really set them on their path. So it was just so much fun to write. And I've never done anything even remotely historical. So to be able to go back and research that time period and find out all these wonderful details was just amazing. And I have a whole new respect for historical writers, for sure.
Because, of course, in the storyline of Lovey, that would be Annabelle's grandmother, among other things, you take us back to World War II times and
right.
to what life was like in the immediate aftermath and so on. And it comes to life very, very authentically. I want to ask you about something else that's a real hallmark of many novels. And it seems to me that in especially a lot of novels that are set in the South is that so often they will be peppered with sort of life observations, sort of philosophical observations about sort of the way the world works, and kind of the way that if you were sitting on the porch and your grandmother was in a rocking chair and she might kind of share kind of nuggets of her homespun wisdom about sort of the way the world works. And certainly we receive that along the way in this book as well. Just wonder if you could kind of talk a moment about where those tend to come. For instance, the very first chapter opens with, "My grandmother Lovey says that there are two types of people in the world, the kind who flee to the shelters at the first threat of a hurricane and the kind who wait it out, hovering over their possessions as if their fragile lives offer any protection against a natural mother that can take them out of the world as quickly as she brought them into it." That's a great little observation. I think I agree with it. Where did that come from? And is that, for instance, the way you see the world? I mean, how often are these sort of snippets of a given character's sort of life philosophy your own?
And I think that's one of the tricky parts, especially about writing, because, you know, sometimes I might write a character who has very different views than I do. And you worry about that a little bit because you think, oh, gosh, I don't want people to think that I think that. You know, those types of things.
Right.
Not with something like that, of course, because it's more of kind of a grandmother's front porch life philosophy. But, you know, you do write characters who, you know, are not nice and they're not, you know, I mean, you definitely write characters that have different viewpoints from what you do. And so that is always something that I think about. I'm told that over the years that will get easier and I won't think about that anymore. but especially, I guess, you know, being kind of new at it, I do think about that. But those life observations, you know, I'm really lucky because I grew up down the street from my mom's parents, and I still have them. They're still alive and still very much a part of my life. And I thought about my grandmother a lot while I was writing this story and, you know, what would she say to me in this situation? And really, she is just one of those people. She's one of the first people that I call, you know, in any kind of given situation, sort of like Annabelle does with Lovey, because she just has such a different perspective. You know, she has kind of the knowledge and the wisdom and maybe the distance to be able to see, you know, this really isn't that important. You know, one of her favorite things she always says to me, "This too shall pass." You know, it's just, you know, in 10 years, this is not going to be something that you're worried about. And so I really thought about her a lot when I was writing these characters. And I really wanted to show this wisdom. You know, we get some of Lovey's mother because this is, a lot of it is set in sort of the World War II era. You get some of Lovey's mother as well. And so I really wanted to kind of bring in that element of having this wisdom and this knowledge that's passed down through these four generations of women, but really with the knowledge that it's been passed down much longer than that and will continue to be. And I just thought, you know, for all the things that Annabelle's going through in her life, you get to see in this book that Lovey's really been in a lot of these same places. And so she's in a really good position to be able to offer, you know, this advice and wisdom and guidance to her granddaughter. And for the most part, she takes it. I think one of my favorite parts of the book is Lovey tells Annabelle, you know, once everyone figures out you're not perfect, the rest of your life is a lot easier. And that's one of my favorite things that Lovey says to Annabelle, because, you know, she's made some mistakes and she's done some things that her family isn't proud of. But I think her grandmother kind of has the distance to be able to realize that, you know, your mistakes don't define you.
Right. Before we talk about these characters with a little more specificity and what they have experienced, we should talk about the matter of lies, which, of course, is the first word in the title of the book, and it brings to mind something else said by the character of Lovey. That would be Annabelle's grandmother. One chapter opens this way. My mama always told me that honesty was the most important thing in life, but I've never understood why people are so hell-bent on honesty. It's not the truth that sets you free. The truth is the thing that destroys lives, that shatters the mirror. The truth is selfish and shameful and better kept to oneself. In fact, I'm quite sure that the only things that paperclip any of our lives together are the white lies. They are the defibrillators that bring us back when we were on the brink of succumbing to the light. That is such an interesting turn of phrase, and of course it's a very, very interesting way of sort of looking at life and looking at the world. It almost seems like a revolutionary way of looking at the world, except that the closer we read it, the more we realize that quite a lot of us live a fair amount of our lives probably following this principle, even if it's something we don't dare really admit out loud.
Right. Well, and, you know, I think through the course of this book, you know, you see some secrets and they come to light in some certain ways. And I really, truly, you know, again, this is not something that I necessarily believe, but at the same time, I think when you become a parent, you start to look at the world in a different way. And like I said, you know, I do have a child, and you know, someone asked me earlier this morning in an interview, you know, do you believe this? Like, do you think that everyone lies to protect people that they love? And I said, you know, in the simplest, smallest ways, I mean, if you're sitting at the dinner table with your three-year-old and the news is on and, you know, it's a story about suicide bombings, you probably change the channel. And some people would say that's a lie because you're not telling your child the truth about the world. But you do things to protect your children. And I think that my premise for this story is that you don't just do things to protect your children when they're young. You do things to protect their children, to protect your children their entire lives. And one of the things that Lovey does in this book, you know, there are obviously some secrets and some lies that are told in this book that I, you know, can't tell because it ruins the story. But, you know, one of the things is she's taking care of her husband, who's always taking care of her. You know, he's always been the pillar of the family. He's always been in charge. He was kind of the strong, invincible man. And she puts on such a brave face for her children. You know, that life is business as usual, that everything is okay. And inside, she doesn't feel that way at all, which is what you see in the book. But she wants to make it easier for her children. And you can call that what you will, but it's a lie. And so, you know, these are really the types of things that the story questions and that the story, you know, asks of the reader to make decisions. And I really tried to write the book in a way that, and if you, you know, you've read it and so you know the ending, but I really tried to write the book in a way that at the end, the reader gets to make that decision. You know, was this the right decision? Was it the wrong decision? What would have happened, you know, if this had turned out differently? And I think, you know, those are just kind of those things that make story interesting, and they can kind of, we can bring our own viewpoint and our own sort of set of life circumstances to it. But the more I wrote this story, the more I really did kind of think, as much as some of us think, wow, I am honest to a fault. You know, we all have things that we hide, and a lot of times it's for a very selfless reason.
We're speaking with Christy Woodson Harvey, and we're talking about her newest novel, which is called Lies and Other Acts of Love. We spoke to her previously about her first novel called Dear Carolina. Christy Woodson Harvey, let's talk about, first of all, the grandmother in this story, Lynn Lovey White. Lovey is the nickname that actually Annabelle herself, I think, attached to her, and it's stuck ever since. And she is a marvelous character, exactly the kind of person that we sort of wish was in our own life. And yet at the same time, she does not feel like a cardboard character, but like somebody who is a flesh and blood character. And particularly when we learn about sort of conflicting influences on her life. I want you to tell our listeners about something which she did, which involved a trip off to New York City when she was a young person, which really helped change the course of the life she lived after.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, that was one of my very favorite parts of this whole book to write. I loved writing that story. It was just wonderful. But Levy, well, she's Lynn still at that time. No one's named her Levy yet. But Lynn is from this tiny, tiny town called Bath in North Carolina. And it's small now, but, you know, you can imagine in that time it was even smaller. And so this was during World War II, and this, you know, cosmetics company, and this was something that was sort of based on things that I had heard that these cosmetics companies actually did. They would come to these small towns, and they would have these, like, makeover contests, and people would be photographed. And if you won the contest, you got these amazing prizes. And so, you know, Lynn takes her best friend, Katie Jo, and says, we're going to go, and we're going to do this makeover contest, and, you know, we're just going to have a fun day, never really imagining that she will actually win. And the prize for the winner is 3 weeks in New York City, which compared to Bath, North Carolina in the 40s, could not possibly be more different places. And then there's subtle things, too, that we don't really think about today. But, you know, she wins 4 pairs of shoes, which during that time, you couldn't have, with all the, you know, all of the rations, you couldn't have had 4 pairs of shoes if you wanted them. You know, so these things that we just sort of take for granted that are, you know, we can just run out and do, were things that were really amazing and kind of life-changing. But anyway, she wins this trip to New York City, and her parents are like, there's absolutely no way that we will let our little North Carolina daughter, you know, go off to this big city. And I'm pretty sure, as they say, fall in love with a Yankee, because that would have been a fear at that time. But she sneaks out and she goes away, and she has this amazing, wonderful trip at the Waldorf, which, you know, at that time was the height of luxury, and just kind of has this once-in-a-lifetime experience of spending these 3 weeks in this magical city that's so different from where she's from.
And if I can just jump in, because I love this description as she is thinking about what that experience was like. I mean, first of all, you know, to win this contest, and yeah, she'd never won anything except the English award at her school. Yeah. And she thinks to herself, and it was like Edison discovering electricity. The light was on, and I didn't ever want to go back to the dark. And part of what she's talking about is experiencing something so exciting, even just in the winning of this contest, but then in going to New York, which was this amazing experience, which helped her understand this extraordinary world that was out there that she really knew very, very little about. I just love the way you kind of bring that sense of excitement and anticipation alive.
Well, thank you. Well, and I think the most exciting part, and I won't tell the readers what happens because I think that's one of the fun parts, but she ends up being in New York the day that the war is over. And I have a family friend that this happened to. She had, you know, had sort of an experience like this, and won this amazing trip and ended up being at the Waldorf in New York the day, in Times Square, the day that the war was over, and just saying, you know, that's a life experience that no one gets to have. I mean, who gets to do that? And so that was really a fun element to get to bring in. But that's a very pivotal moment in the book, as you see when you read it.
Right. And then, of course, as life has sometimes serves up, the big plans which she ultimately has with the man she ultimately marries do not quite pan out. And she ultimately ends up with a life that is much closer to home, not out and about in the most far-flung parts of the world, although she and her husband always love to travel and, in a sense, always have this tremendous sense of hunger for seeing exciting places in the world while being also tightly rooted to home. I love that complexity about them.
Well, thank you. Well, and I think, too, you know, I think one of the things that she realizes when she gets home is that, you know, she loved to go, but in her heart, you know, she's really a small-town Southern girl. And I think, you know, a lot of people can relate to that, to wanting to go and have these experiences, but not necessarily thinking that they are right for you and for the rest of your life. And, you know, in Levy's case, I mean, love really dictates her course through her entire life. And I think that's one of, you know, the things about her, and that's one of the stories that I really wanted to tell, was a story about real love, that, goes through some really difficult things. You know, I think a lot of times we read stories about, well, maybe a little bit like Annabelle's. You know, we read stories about hearts and butterflies and sugar cookies, and, you know, it's wonderful and everyone lives happily ever after. But kind of what happens after that, and what does 60 years of happily ever after really look like, and what does that entail? And I really wanted to tell that story.
Hmm. And I really appreciate, too, the fact that, that for instance, Lovey and her own mother, so this would be Annabelle's great-grandmother, were very different in, for instance, this regard, this particular sort of hunger for exciting experience. One chapter opens for Lovey this way. She thinks, my mama always thought I was part gypsy. I couldn't read palms or crystal balls, but from the time I was little, I'd go anywhere and do anything, sacrifice whatever necessary to have a new experience. My mama never left North Carolina once, and she was just fine with that. But me, I wanted to see the world. And I just find that so intriguing to think about the ways in which, you know, so often we have a mother and a daughter who might love each other and yet be fundamentally different from one another when it comes to a matter like this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do think that writing Lovey's mother was fun. And, of course, she's not a huge part of the story or anything like that, and we only see her in glimpses. But I really, you know, liked sort of the juxtaposition of these four generations of women. And you really kind of get to see them. And you especially get to see it, I think, in Annabelle's mother, Jean, and her four sisters. You know, Lovey has five daughters, and they're all very, very different from each other. And I think that happens, you know, and there's some parts where, you know, one of them says, how did you raise her and all of us in the same family? You know, how does this happen? But I think when you come from a big family and, you know, you have a lot of people in your life, you do just end up being very different from one another. And I think that's one of the beautiful, wonderful things about family.
Absolutely. And we do get to meet these five sisters, including Annabelle's mother, Jean, who is also the mayor of their little town. But each one has their own particular personality. Lovey is experiencing a couple of difficulties in her life as this novel begins. She has been married for 60 years, but her husband has, I believe, suffered a stroke and is nothing like he once was. And she finds herself needing to really care for him night and day. And the fact that he is, in a sense, sort of emotionally and mentally vacant so much of the time is of course tremendously sad, and then the other thing that rides right on top of that sadness is the looming possibility that perhaps Lovey is going to have to leave the house that she loves so much out of just practical necessity. I think you write about this so authentically. Is this something you yourself have sort of lived through? I mean, obviously not you specifically, but maybe somebody you know or love. Otherwise, how are you able to tap into the sort of the core of sadness and bewilderment that is part of such a transition?
Well, this is really interesting because the only people that read my stories before they go to my editor are my mom and her three sisters and my mother-in-law. So they're the people that get to read my books before they go to New York. So I actually wrote Lies and Other Acts of Love maybe 3 years ago. How old am I? Yeah, like 3 years ago. And so the really interesting part about this is that was during a time when, you know, my grandfather, you know, had some declining health and that kind of thing. And it was a time where, you know, my mom and her sisters were beginning to discuss with my grandmother, you know, we know you want to be at home with him, and we know that this is great, but we really feel like, you know, you maybe need more help than just having the caregivers come in and that kind of thing. But none of this had actually happened. And so the really interesting thing is that after the book, you know, was to press and was coming out and all those sorts of things. Some of these things did start to happen. So my mom and my aunts have joked, you wrote the future. You made these things happen. But I think, you know, like I said, I'm really close with my grandparents. And so I've, you know, really seen this transition in their life. And to really think about what that must be like for my grandmother, it wasn't really a stretch because I feel like I know her so well. That to kind of put myself in that position of what Lovie might be feeling. You know, I did have some sort of true and authentic situations in which to draw on. But the interesting thing is that a lot like Lovie, my grandmother is very strong. You know, she's very stoic, and she always makes sure that, you know, we think that all is well, even if it's not. And so I think for me, a lot of this was kind of imagining what must this really be like for her, you know, to have your whole life sort of turned upside down. And so in that way, you know, I do think there's definitely an authentic element to it.
Hmm. This is really some wonderful writing you do here as you help sort of usher us right into Lovie's heart. On the one hand, you really help us understand why she herself also feels this mounting sense that she can no longer remain in the home with her husband, so fearful that some night something is going to happen. I mean, and she is going to be unable to help her husband or rescue him from, you know, whatever might calamity that, you know, if a fire started or whatever it might be. I mean, we really sense her fear so potently. But you also describe Lovie's attachment to everything that is in that home, including everything which at least a couple of her daughters probably regard as kind of useless junk that should be discarded. I mean, certainly at least a couple of her daughters feel pretty strongly about that. And this is what Lovie says at this point. I peered down into the drawer on my lap and looked at the stack of papers and clippings in my hand. My girls looked in these drawers and saw a bunch of old junk. They didn't realize that this receipt from Penny's was for the pram that Dan surprised me with when we first found out I was pregnant with Sally, or that I could just see Louise's happy little face when she brought me this kindergarten report card filled with satisfactory marks. I glimpsed a photo of Dan and the girls standing in front of our old house in Bath and realized that, as it is with all lives, the memories that filled these drawers weren't universally happy, but they were universally mine. Really appreciate that, because I think a lot of us find ourselves in this situation, either with our own lives or the lives of a loved one, not necessarily fully appreciating all the stuff that fills one's house can have meaning far beyond what might be obvious at a glance.
Yeah, and you know, I think, well, first of all, it's really interesting to hear someone else read your book back to you. this one hasn't come out on audio yet, so it's really interesting to kind of hear you. I'm like, wow, I really like that. I do think that is true, and I think people have different levels of sort of attachment to their things and sentimentality, you know, that is attached to their things. And I also think, you know, one of the differences, too, that it's easy to disregard when you're young and you have all of your memories. But as you get older and those memories sort of start to fade, you know, either because you're losing them or because you just have so many more that you don't remember everything, then I think that attachment does naturally become stronger. And then I also think, you know, there is a little bit of, you know, these characters would have grown up during the Depression. And I do think that is a large distinction, because they knew what it was to have everything and then have nothing and not be able to get anything. And so I do think that's a difference as well. And I think that subtly has informed Lynn and Dan's characters. I don't think you see that too much in the story, but it's something that, you know, in subtle moments I try to sort of, you know, work in there in some ways.
The other main character whose narrative alternates with Lovie's is her granddaughter, Annabelle. And much of what we learn about Annabelle has to do with an amazing choice that she has made to leave, not quite at the altar, but just about, a very solid, dependable man to whom she is engaged, leaves him and runs into the arms of a of an older but handsome, charismatic singer. And it is a choice which is shocking to many people, in part because this is the kind of thing she would not necessarily do at the drop of a hat. It's in some ways at least, a bit uncharacteristic, and yet it's something that she has to do. It would be so easy to describe something like this in sort of cliche-ridden fashion, and I really appreciate the fact that you don't. I mean, I think we really come to understand just how such a thing could actually happen, and in the moment make all the sense in the world. Talk more about how you went about describing these two people and their relationship in order to allow it to resonate so authentically with us.
Well, you know, I think for one thing, I mean, Annabelle is 22. She's very young, and she's kind of at this big crossroads in her life where, you know, she knows that marrying Holden, who is the guy she's engaged to, like, she knows it's something that she's supposed to want, but she somehow just doesn't really see herself in this life. And so, you know, she does make sort of an impetuous decision, and it may or may not be the right one, but she, you know, sort of ends up impulsively marrying this guy that she falls madly in love with after 3 days, and her family is, of course, horrified that she would do such a thing. And, you know, I think this, not everyone goes to these extremes of bad choices, and not everyone goes through a stage where they make bad choices. I was pretty level-headed at 22. I would definitely not have married a guy I met in a bar 3 days later. But I think that sometimes, you know, it's called the quarter-life crisis for a reason. You know, sometime around our, you know, 20s and early 30s, a lot of us do sort of have these kinds of, oh, my goodness, what am I doing with my life? This is real, you know, sort of moments. And sometimes in the wake of that, don't make the best decisions. Annabelle certainly, you know, makes a few bad ones on her own. But I also think, you know, Annabelle is going through a lot. You know, she's had a really nice life, and everything's kind of gone well for her and all of that, but she does sort of make this bad decision that her family is not terribly happy with. And for all intents and purposes, I mean, she's the one that sort of discovers, you know, the secret in her family, and she's watching, you know, the two closest people in the world to her sort of in decline, and she's kind of dealing with that. And so it's sort of like in one fell swoop, everything that has been Annabelle's life kind of crumbles to the ground. And so I think, you know, she is kind of in this place where her picture-perfect life is all of a sudden not quite so rosy. And she has to deal with that, and she has to come through that, and she has to find her way out of that. And I think that if we really look back and we really think about it, that most of us have been at one of those crossroads in our lives before where we really have to take a hard look at, you know, who we are and what we're doing and what's the right thing. And we don't always make the best decisions, but I think for the most part, it ends up working out in the end.
Right. One of the things I guess I really appreciate about the way you shaped this moment in the book is that, yes, on several different levels, this feels like a really bad decision that she is making, or at least a really reckless one. Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, given what she feels, it also feels like, in a sense, an inescapable choice. I mean, if we were looking over her shoulder, we would never say she was stupid or foolish, even if we might think this choice she's making is stupid or foolish. She's not doing it for stupid or foolish reasons. It feels so, in a sense, inescapable or inevitable, because just the power of the connection that they feel overrides every practical consideration.
Well, and you know, you see Annabelle throughout the book. She is very intuitive. She makes a lot of decisions, kind of gut decisions, and I actually can relate to that because I'm very much like that. I make a lot of gut decisions. I've always been very definitely not impulsive because I really think things through, but at the end of the day, if I'm going with, you know, my head or just my gut feeling, usually my gut feeling wins the day, and I think the more that, you know, those gut feelings turn out to be right, the more that you trust them. But I think when you're younger, you know, you're sort of learning to gauge when your head needs to intervene a little bit and when it doesn't. And And, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's just like everything else. All the decisions that we make in our life, whether they're good or they're bad, they lead us to where we are. And generally, we can look back and think, if I hadn't had that experience, I wouldn't be here now. And I think, you know, that is important. And I think it's an important part of Annabelle's story. And I think Annabelle, you know, for me, she's a little bit of a comment on human nature. I mean, I can look at myself now. Actually, writing Annabelle was very eye-opening because I think it's really easy to look at your friends and be like, oh, my gosh, they make the same bad decision over and over again. But when we really look at ourselves, I mean, we are brilliant at convincing ourselves that we're going to do the same thing again, but it's going to be different this time. You know, we're really, really good at that. We're so good at, like, convincing ourselves why it's going to be different this time, even though we're doing the same thing.
Right.
And I think Annabelle really embodies that, and I, you know, I hope readers get that from her, that they, you know, kind of can start to see some of those traits in their own lives.
Absolutely. And at one point you say, you know, when it comes to lies, the lies, here it is, the lies that matter most are the ones we tell ourselves. So
exactly.
That's what you're saying. I appreciated the fact that when it came to her interactions with the man to whom she was engaged, Holden, who was like a hedge fund manager, I think, right?
Yeah.
And someone who would have given her a very stable a life of affluence, most likely. She ended up, giving him the news over the phone in very, very abrupt, kind of unfortunate fashion. And the first time they actually speak in person after that, she ends up having to be very, very firm to the point of being pretty cold and callous. And it's because he has not given up and still harbors hope that that she will come to her senses and that they will still be together. Annabelle's thinking to herself then, but I knew that in his mind, Holden's mind, if the curtains were fluttering in the breeze, I needed to slam the window or it was going to come up open again and again and again. I just love that picture of if somebody has hopes, it's like the breeze fluttering through the curtains. And sometimes it might seem like the kindest thing to do is to just slam that window shut so that that hope is snuffed out.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think Holden is one of those. Well, first of all, I do think that, you know, I've had a lot of readers say to me, and I appreciate this, that, that they have very much felt like they have had a Ben, a Holden, and a Rob in their life. And I think that a lot of us have felt like that. You know, there's a lot of times there's the guy who is stable and he's good on paper and you love him and you know that he'll give you a great life, but somehow he's just not right and because you just don't feel that thing that you're supposed to feel. And then, you know, sometimes you have the guy that he's totally the wrong guy, but you're just crazy for him and you feel like you can't live without him. And then, you know, hopefully somewhere in there, there's kind of a happy medium and a middle ground of someone who really is right for you. And they may not be perfect on paper and they may not be right for anybody else. And they may not make you feel just like you're going to lose your mind every time you're with them, but you also, you know, feel that thing that you're supposed to feel when you fall in love. And so that was really interesting to me, like the women that have come to me and said, oh, my goodness, you know, I've had all of these people in my life. And I think when you're, you know, if you are someone who dates and you've, you know, been out with different people, that at some point in your life you probably do encounter these different people. And, you know, Holden is a great guy, and I think he sort of understands Annabelle in a way that a lot of people don't, and I think that's why he's sort of willing to fight for her, because he's had enough distance to really understand kind of the position that she was in and the life that she's had and sort of where she was coming from. And so I appreciated that about Holden, and I think that, you know, he is a good guy, and, you know, wish good things for sweet Holden.
Right. But on the other hand, of course, this singer named Ben is so handsome and so interesting and so articulate and intelligent and sweeps her off her feet. And we'll leave it to our listeners to read that whole scene. But that's just an incredibly vibrant, vivid passage in which we really understand how even somebody usually as sensible as Annabelle could find herself swept away by his charm and charisma. What I really find interesting at the end of one of the earlier chapters is when someone is actually, it's Holden at the end of this face-to-face encounter, which goes very badly. As Annabelle is walking away, Holden calls out after her, "He's going to hurt you, Annabelle." Everyone thinks so, that as everyone thinks Ben is going to ultimately hurt Annabelle. And this is what she thinks as she walks away. "I wanted to laugh indignantly, but the words pierced right through me. The spear he had thrown in retaliation for the arrow I shot. It was the first time I had considered what it might be like to be without Ben. How devastated, confused, and completely alone I would be if he changed his mind." That was the benefit of being with someone like Holden. He was good on paper, decent husband material, and if all went down the tubes, well, then, oh well, my attachment was minimal. But to think about being without Ben was like losing my limbs. I loved him with a ferocity I'd never known before. I would look at him when we were lying in bed at night, him peacefully snoring beside me, and I would consider the fact that he was a good deal older, and I would start to panic. How would I ever live without him? How would the breath enter and leave my body if Ben was not there to regulate it? I really am glad you take the time to share that passage with us, because I think it really also helps us understand part of what can be downright frightening about young love as intense as this, and why people caught up in it sometimes make the choices that they do.
Yeah, and I think, you know, she does, I'm reading that, you're reading that, and I'm like, wow, yeah, she loves him. You know, I mean, she really does. And I think that relationship also gives her kind of a glimpse into what her grandmother must be going through. You know, I think that was one of the real purposes of Ben and Annabelle's relationship, is that, you know, she really starts to consider what it must be like for her grandmother to have suddenly lost, you know, her entire world for all intents and purposes, you know, this person that she really loved. And so, you know, I think that was another kind of interesting aspect of that. But I think sometimes these things are the right thing. You know, sometimes you meet someone and you feel that thing, and I know lots of people that's happened. I mean, I didn't marry my husband after 3 days, but I saw him for the first time and said, "That's the man I'm going to marry." And, you know, I think sometimes you do sort of know these things on an intuitive level, and sometimes under different sets of circumstances they can work out, and sometimes they don't. And I also think, you know, in that passage when he says, you know, "He's going to hurt you, everyone thinks so," that's also sort of a comment on small town Southern life, because, you know, when you do something, everyone is talking about you. Like, you are under the microscope, and especially when you make a bad decision, it is like everyone in town wants to know about it. So that was, you know, that is another reason that I think Annabelle is very under the microscope and sort of feels a lot of pressure after she's done this thing that she did.
Right. And I also find it really interesting that when Annabelle and Ben have this very first encounter where she watches him sing, and, well, again, we'll leave the details to our listeners to read in your great book, they eventually end up at the local Waffle House and have a late-night meal together. And it's where we start to really learn a little more about him, besides how handsome he is and how smooth-talking he is. Here is Annabelle then saying, "I was so fully and completely charmed by Ben, and when I looked into his eyes, it was like I knew him, too. Sitting across the table, I instinctively felt that I understood him better than anyone else ever would, that I could see what was inside of him." I've never stopped to think about it, but it seems like, in a sense, that is one facet of what someone might call love, or, you know, head over heels love at first sight, is this notion that somehow we can see right into the depths of this person and understand them, even though in any sort of rational way, it's impossible. we know almost nothing about them. And yet this sense of understanding them, whatever exactly that is, is certainly has to be a powerful point of connection.
Yeah, and that never changes for Annabelle. You know, and I think that's, you know, I wanted that to sort of stay the same. And I do think that, you know, like I said, I mean, you have to read the book, but I do think that that sometimes there are people who, you know, you do connect with, not even just romantically, but even, you know, people that you meet as friends, and you'll meet them somewhere and you'll think you just have this kind of bond right away, and you feel like, wow, I've known this person forever. And I don't exactly know what that is, but it's very interesting to me. It's it's something that I've experienced, and especially, honestly, through writing books and, like, being on tour all the time and going different places. And sometimes you meet people that you just kind of click with right away, and you think, like, wow, we feel like we've been best friends forever, and we've known each other 2 days. So I do think, you know, even outside of kind of those romantic realms, sometimes those things happen, and they're sort of inexplicable and magical. But I this reminds me, when you talk about Waffle House, I had a friend text me last night, and she was on that page, and she said, I have to tell you that, you know, one, I love the book, and two, I'm pretty impressed that you used the words Waffle House and Gabriel Garcia Marquez in the same sentence.
I like the fact, too, that when they walk in, the fact that the waitress knows this, knows Ben by name, and they have this wonderful rapport, that, you know, this makes it a little less likely that he's a serial killer or, or some other sort of despicable character. It helps when the waitress at the Waffle House knows exactly who you are.
Exactly. Gives you a little credibility.
Right. Absolutely. And we haven't even touched on, but unfortunately there is no time to touch on, another interesting friendship that enters the situation when Annabelle befriends the local Episcopalian priest and actually starts doing some part-time work for the Episcopalian parish in town. And this ushers in a whole nother layer of complexity into a life that's already quite interesting, as she tries to figure out, where does she fit into this new community, and who is she supposed to be, what is she meant to do, and what about she and Ben, and can they weather the troubles that, of course, inevitably emerge. It's all woven together so beautifully in this wonderful novel, again, called Lies and Other Acts of Love. And I do want to mention that towards the back of it a set of discussion questions that I think are especially well done. Are those questions that you wrote, or somebody from Berkeley Books?
Yeah, I did not write those. Somebody from Berkeley wrote those, but I do think they did a nice job. And the book's only been out 2 weeks, and I've already been to several book clubs to discuss this book. So if you have a book club, it's definitely good. Those are good discussion questions. They did a really good job with them. And I think there's a lot to discuss in this book. You and I have had a pretty easy time, and we haven't even really gotten through a lot yet.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've even managed to steer around certain things that you obviously don't want us to talk about in the interview.
Right.
We want to leave it to our listeners to uncover these for themselves in this terrific novel. Again, it's called Lies and Other Acts of Love, published by Berkeley Books. Christy Woodson Harvey, what a pleasure to reconnect with you. Congratulations on this very successful second novel, and best wishes with all your future writing.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate you having me. It was great.
Whew, there we go. Okay, that was fun. Yeah,
that was fun. You're so good at this.
Oh, well, thanks. There's a lot to talk about, and when it's, you know, this good a book, it's
thank you. That means a lot to me. And like, that is really neat to hear someone else read your book back to you. I was kind of like, oh, especially because I haven't read it in so long. I thought, oh, that's neat. I forgot about that.
There you go.
Well, thank you. And would you mind, I would love to be able to put this on my website. Do you have, like, when it airs, will it be online?
Absolutely.
Can I link to it? Okay.
Absolutely. Was this with Steve Becker or Chuck Monroe?
Chuck Monroe.
Okay. I can certainly fire off a link to him. We'll air this next week. I don't remember exactly when, but once it airs, then it will be right there on our website and available for anybody to click on and listen to. And that would be terrific. I'm honored you want to do that. So
yeah, no, it was such a great interview. I really appreciate it. Thank you. For taking all the time to read the book and know all that about it. I really appreciate it.
Actually, it's interesting. I sort of semi on purpose have not read the last third or so.
Okay.
I actually don't know yet where it goes. So this weekend I look forward to finishing it up. So.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, at least read the last chapter.
Oh, first, no, I'm reading the whole thing. No question. But I thought in some ways it's easier to do an interview like this when you don't know where it's all headed.
And
yeah,
I agree.
You can kind of, that kind of ignorance is helpful. So, all right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.